fly almost as well as you do. I could drop one in your seat, paint the head blue, and at least I'd stop getting lip. Sorry, Cobb, Bim said. No lip intended, but... I mean, I talked to some cadets from Firestorm Flight this morning. They've been dogfighting this entire time.
Good for them. When they're all dead, you can move into their room.
Cobb sighed, loudly, in an exaggerated way.
Here, let's try this.
A set of glowing golden rings appeared on the battlefield. They were just larger than a ship, and several were dangerously close to floating chunks of debris.
Line up and confirm, Cobb said. You heard the man? Jerkface said. Fall in at my mark.
The eight of us flew to Jerkface's ship and settled into a line, then gave him verbal confirmation.
Flight ready, instructor, Jerkface said. Here are the rules, Cobb said. Each ring you pass through gets you 1 point. Once you begin a run, you have to maintain a speed of at least Mach 1, and you can't circle around if you miss a ring. There are 5 rings, and I'll let you each do 3 runs through the course. Highest score gets 2 desserts tonight. But a warning, if you crash, you're out with your score frozen where it was before you died.
I perked up and tried not to dwell on the idea that the prize was useless to me. At least this might distract me from the uncomfortable helmet.
A game? Pearl said. Like, you're actually going to let us have fun? I can have fun, Cobb said. I know all about having fun. Most of it involves sitting and dreaming of the day when you all stop asking me stupid questions.
Ned chuckled.
That wasn't a joke, Cobb said. Go.
Pearl whooped and hit her overburn, zipping toward the debris field. I responded nearly as fast, accelerating to Mag 3, and almost beat her to the first ring. I flew through it right behind her, then glanced at my radar. Bim, FM, and Morningtide were on my tail. Arturo and Ned flew in formation, as they often did. I expected Kimmelin to be last, but she actually flew ahead of Jerkface, who delayed for some reason. I focused on the course, racing through the next ring. The third one was practically behind a big chunk of debris. The only way through it at speed would be to use a light lance to turn extra sharp. Pearl whooped again and executed a near-perfect hook turn through the ring. I made the tactical decision to shoot past it, which proved wise as Bim tried to pivot through it and smashed right into the chunk of debris.
Scud! He yelled as his ship exploded.
Jerkface still hasn't started the course, I noted. I made the fourth ring. It hovered between 2 hunks of debris, but missed the last one, which was behind a large floating metal box, requiring a light lance turn to spin around it. I ended that run with 3 points, though Hurl got 4. I hadn't counted the others. Poor Kimmelin crashed getting through the fourth ring. The rest of us curved around the outside of the debris field for another run, and Jerkface finally flew in for his first run. He was watching to see us go through, I realized. He was scouting the battlefield. Clever. Indeed, he got 4 rings like Hurl. Pearl immediately raced in for her second run, and I realized that, in our eagerness, we'd been going several times faster than Cobb's stated minimum speed. Why would we want to fly faster? Simply to get done first? Cobb hadn't offered any points for that. Stupid, I thought. It isn't a race. It's a test of precision. I slowed down to Mag 1 as Hurl, trying to hook that third ring again for the sharp turn, lost control and slammed herself into a nearby chunk of rock.
Ha!
She exclaimed. She didn't seem to care that she'd lost. She just seemed happy that there was a game to it now. I focused on the third ring, going over and over in my head the things Cobb had taught. As I swooped past, I launched my light lance into the asteroid and not only hooked it, but, to my surprise, swung around on the energy line so that I curved right through the ring. Bim whistled.
Nice one, spin!
I released the light lance and pulled up.
You want to try this one, Arturo?
Ned asked as the two of them flew toward the third ring.
I think our chances of victory are higher if we skip that ring each pass. Too bad, Ned said, then hooked Arturo with his light lance and pulled him after, diving for the ring. Of course, they both crashed. I hit the fourth ring easily, zipping between the two flying chunks of debris. But I missed the fifth one, spearing only air with my light lance. Ned, you idiot, Arturo said in my ear. Why did you do that?
I wanted to see what would happen, Ned answered.
You wanted... Ned, it was obvious what would happen. You just got us both killed.
Better here than the real world.
Better neither. Now we won't win.
I never eat my first dessert, though, Ned said. Bad for the bod, my friend.
The two went on bickering over the radio. FM, I noticed, didn't try either of the difficult rings. She stuck to the three that were easier. I gritted my teeth, focusing on the contest. I had to beat Jorgen. It was a matter of honor. He finished his second run with 4 points again, making the third ring but skipping the last one, which was hardest. That put him at 8 points, and me at only 7. FM, playing it safe, would be at 6. I wasn't sure about Morningtide, but she tried the last ring and missed, so I was probably ahead of her. The four of us remaining swooped around for our final run. Again, Jerkface hung back, waiting for the rest of us to go first. Fine, I thought, hitting Overburn and zipping through the first ring. I had to hit every one of these to have a chance. FM, notably, didn't try to fly through even the first ring. She just zoomed carefully over the top of the course.
FM, what are you doing?
Cobb asked. I figure these clowns will all get themselves killed, sir. I could probably win without any points at all. No, I thought, streaking through the second ring. He said we keep our points if we crash. We merely can't get any more. So she wouldn't win, careful or not. Cobb had accounted for that. I approached the third ring, hands sweating. Come on. Go. I launched the light lance and hit the debris square on, but didn't push into the throttle the right way, so I ended up swinging around, but missed the ring. I gritted my teeth, but disengaged the light lance and managed to pull out of the turn without smashing into anything. Morningtide tried the ring and almost made it, but ended up crashing. Jerkface still waited outside, watching to see exactly how many rings he'd need to win. Clever. Again. Scud, I hated that boy. I was so distracted that I actually missed the fourth ring, which was one of the easy ones. Furious, my face growing cold, I used my light line to spear the big square piece of debris, then spun downward, curving straight through the fifth ring, which, so far as I'd seen, nobody had hit. That left me with a total of 10 points, while Jerkface was at 8. He would close that gap easily. I felt my anger boil as he finally started toward the course. Who did he think he was, sitting back there like some ancient king, watching the plebes scramble before him? He was so arrogant. But worse, he'd been right to wait. He'd been smarter than I had, and he'd gained a distinct advantage. He was going to win. Unless... A terrible idea took root in my mind. I spun and hit my overburn, accelerating to Mag 5 and sprinting back toward the starting line. Above me, Jerkface went through the first ring at a leisurely pace, at exactly the minimum speed.
Hey, spin? Ned asked. What you doing?
I ignored him, turning upward, dodging through floating pieces of debris. Ahead of me, Jerkface approached the second ring, an easy one, and the one that would bring him to 10 points. Straight on, I thought, overburning. Pushing my acceleration to the red line of where, in a climb like this, I'd risk dropping unconscious.
Spin?
Bim asked. I grinned, then smashed my ship right into Jerkface's, overwhelming both shields and blowing us to pieces. We exploded into light. Then we both reformed at the edge of the battlefield.
What the hell was that? Jerkface shouted. What were you thinking?
I was thinking how to win, I said, sitting back in my seat, satisfied.
The way of the warrior, Jerkface.
We're on a team, Spin, he said.
You brash, self-centered, slimy piece of...
Enough, Jorgen,
Cobb snapped. Jerkface fell quiet, but notably didn't give his usual obsequious yes, sir. The hologram switched off, and Cobb walked over to my seat.
You're dead.
I won anyway, I said.
It's a tactic that would be useless in a real fight, Cobb said. You don't get to take home points if you're dead.
I shrugged. You set the rules, Cobb. 10 points for me, 9 for Jerkface. It isn't my fault that he doesn't get to try for the last few points.
Yes, it is, Jerkface said, standing up out of his cockpit. It absolutely is your fault. Enough, son, Cobb said. It's not worth getting worked up over this. You lost. It happens.
He glanced at me.
Though I guess I'll be wanting to change the rules of that game.
I stood up, grinning.
5-minute break, Cobb said. Everyone cool down and don't strangle one another. That causes too much damn paperwork.
He hobbled over to the door and stepped out, perhaps to fetch his midday coffee. Kimmelin ran over to my seat, her dark curls bouncing.
Spin! That was wonderful!
What does the saint say about games? I asked.
You can't win if you don't play, Kimmelin said.
Obviously.
Obviously!
She grinned again. Bim walked by and gave me a thumbs up. Over his shoulder, I saw Jerkface glaring at me with unmitigated hostility as Arturo and Ned tried to calm him down.
Don't worry, Jorg, Ned said. You still beat Arturo.
Thank you very much, Ned, Arturo snapped.
Kimmelin left the classroom to get something to drink, and I settled into my seat and dug one of my canteens out of my pack. I made sure to refill all 3 each day at the bathroom.
So,
Bim said, leaning against my hologram projector.
You're really into warriors and things, eh?
They inspire me, I said. My grandmother tells stories about ancient heroes.
You have any favorites?
Probably Beowulf, I said, and took a long pull of water from the canteen. He literally slew a dragon and ripped the arm off a monster. He had to resort to his bare hands after his sword wouldn't cut the thing. But then there's Tashinamani. She slew the great warrior Custer. And Conan the Sumerian, who fought in the ancient times before riding.
Yeah, they were great, Bim said and winked. I mean, I hadn't heard of them until now, but I'm sure they were great. I'm thirsty.
He blushed and walked off, leaving me confused. He was flirting with me, I realized, stunned. Or, well, trying to. Was that possible? I mean, he was actually cute, so why would he... I looked at him again and caught him in the middle of what seemed like a blush. Scud. That was the strangest thing that had happened to me since starting flight school, and I spent my mornings talking to a slug. I thought about guys, but my life hadn't exactly left me time for that kind of thing. The last time I'd had any romantic inclinations had been when I'd been 8 and had given Rig a particularly nice hatchet I'd made out of a rock and a stick. Then had decided he was gross the next week. Because, well, I'd been 8. I jumped to my feet. Bim? I said. He looked at me again. You ever heard of Odysseus?
No,
he said. He was an ancient hero who fought in the greatest war that ever happened on Earth, the Trojan War. It's said he had a bow so strong that, other than him, only a giant could pull the string back. He had blue hair, you know.
Yeah?
Bim asked. Pretty cool, I said. Then immediately sat down, taking a long gulp from my canteen. Was that smooth? That was smooth, right? I wasn't sure what Sun Tzu or Beowulf would say about flirting with cute guys. Maybe share the skulls of your enemies with them as a gesture of affection? I felt kind of warm and gooey, in a good way, until I spotted Jerkface across the room watching me. I gave him a hard glare. He pointedly turned to Ned and Arturo.
"I guess we shouldn't expect real honor," he said, "from the daughter of Zine Nightshade."
A bolt of coldness shot through me.
"Who?" Ned asked. "Wait, who did you say she was?" "You know," Jerkface said, voice loud enough to carry through the entire room. "Call sign Chaser? The coward of Alta?"
The room went quiet. I could feel everyone's eyes turning toward me. How had he found out? Who had told him? I stood up. Scud. Even Kimmelin seemed to know who Chaser was. Her canteen dropped from her fingers and bounced against the floor, spilling water that she didn't notice.
"Who?"
Morningtide asked.
"What is happen?"
I wanted to flee. Hide. Escape all those eyes. But I would not run. "My father," I said, "was not a coward."
"I'm sorry," Jerkface said. "I'm only stating the official history."
He stared at me with that arrogant, so punchable face. I found myself blushing in embarrassment, then in anger. I shouldn't feel embarrassed. I'd lived practically my entire life with this mantle. I was accustomed to those looks, those whispers. And I wasn't ashamed of my father, right? So why should I care that the others had found out? Good. Fine. I was happy to be Chaser's daughter.
It was just that it had felt nice
to be able to make my own way without standing in anyone's shadow. That thought made me feel like I was betraying my father, and that made me even more angry.
"She lives in a cave, you know,"
Jerkface said to Arturo.
"She goes there every night. The elevator operators told me they watch her hike out into the wilderness because she's not..."
He cut off as Cobb stepped in with a steaming cup of coffee in his hand. Cobb focused immediately on me, then Jerkface.
"Back to your seats,"
he snapped at us.
"We still have work to do today. And Quirk, did you drop that canteen?"
Kimmelin unfroze and picked up her canteen, and everyone climbed into their cockpits without another word. At one point, shortly after we went back to practicing with our light lances, I caught Cobb looking at me with a grim expression, with eyes that seemed to be saying, "It was going to happen eventually, cadet. Are you going to give in?" Never. But that didn't stop me from feeling sick through the whole set of drills. A few hours later, I trailed out of the women's bathroom, canteens refilled. A new pair of MPs walked me to the doors and saw me out, then, like normal, left me there. I trudged across the base grounds, feeling frustrated, angry, and alone. I should have kept going out of the base, on toward my cave. But instead, I took a path around the training building, one that let me walk past the mess hall. I looked through the window there and spotted the others seated along a metal table, chatting, laughing, arguing. They'd even bullied Jerkface into joining them tonight, a rare treat for the plebes, as he usually drove off to the exclusive elevator. Ned said it could reach the lower caverns in under 15 minutes. So there he was, enjoying what I was forbidden, after tossing away my secret like a fistful of expired rations. I hated him. In that moment, I kind of hated them all. I almost hated my father. I stalked off into the night, leaving the base through the front gates. I turned to my left toward the orchard, and the shortcut through it toward the wilderness. My path took me straight past the small hangars where Jerkface parked his hover car. I stopped there in the darkness, eyeing his bay. The front door was closed this time, but the side door was open, and I could see the car inside. It took me all of about half a second to come up with another really terrible idea. Looking around, I didn't see anyone watching. Darkness had come early tonight, the skylights moving away, and the orchard workers had already gone home. I was far enough from the front gates of the base that the guards there shouldn't be able to see me in the gloom. I slipped in the side of the small hangar and closed the door, then lit my light line for a bit of illumination. I found a wrench on the wall of the small shed and pulled open the hood of the blue hover car. Jerkface could walk home tonight. It would only be fair. After all, I had to walk home. And tonight, I would have to do it while lugging a large, car-sized power matrix tied to my back. Chapter 16. I woke up the next morning groggy and sore, with a face full of stuffed bear. I groaned, turning over, my muscles aching. Why did I hurt so much? I bolted upright and flipped on my lightline bracelet, peering out of my cockpit bed. The light illuminated my little kitchen, a pile of mushrooms waiting to be sliced, some rocks I'd placed as seats there, and a car's power matrix, the size of a small nightstand. It lay where I'd dumped it after lugging it all the way to the cavern. I'd been so worn out after that I hadn't plugged it in, but had climbed right into bed. I groaned and flopped back, rubbing my eyes with the heels of my palms. I'd been so angry last night that, well, I hadn't been thinking clearly. Stealing the power matrix had seemed like a great idea, but now the holes in my clever plan were stark. Gee, I wonder who vandalized your car, Jerkface. Could it be the only one of us who wasn't at dinner, and who had immediate and powerful reasons for wanting revenge on you? When it became known that I'd destroyed another cadet's property, I'd get tossed out of flight school so fast I'd get whiplash. I groaned again, a sound that was unhelpfully mimicked by Doomslug, who had snuggled into a spot on the dash. Why? Why couldn't I stay focused? Why did I have to let them get to me? Beowulf or Shun Guan wouldn't let themselves be goaded into acting this stupid. I felt sick as I trudged to Alta that morning. I didn't even have the will to try out the power matrix. As if there were anything I could do to prevent my doom at this point. Why couldn't rational Spensa and determined Spensa get together for a battle briefing once in a while? I fully expected the MPs to be waiting for me, but the guards at the gates just waved me through. Nobody stopped me on my way to the classroom. Jerkface came in while I was settling down in my seat, and he didn't so much as glance at me. Cobb limped in and started class like normal. At one point during a break, I managed to catch Jerkface's eyes. He met them and didn't look away. There was a challenge in them, yes, but how was I to read this? Was he waiting for some specific point to turn me in? As the day progressed and we practiced using the light lances on moving targets, I started to wonder if maybe he wasn't going to get me into trouble. Maybe he was taking the warrior's way. Rather than running to the Admiral for help, was he planning his own vengeance? If that was true, then scud. I might have to give that boy a little respect. Not much, mind you. He'd still aggressively and maliciously branded me a coward in front of the others. Arturo, Ned, FM, and even Bim trod more softly around me, peering at me out of the corners of their eyes. It didn't seem to affect our training, but during our breaks, everyone was dancing around the news. They asked me about other things, then exited conversations quickly. The only one who didn't act odd was Kimmelin. That didn't mean she ignored what had happened, of course. "So," she said, hovering beside my seat as I rested and drank from my canteen. "Is that why you're always so bellicose?" "Bellicose?" I asked, unfamiliar with the word. "So willing to seize the stars with one hand and shove them in your pocket," Kimmelin said. She leaned in as if the next part were somehow naughty. "You know, heated. Heated. Maybe even, once in a while, cross. Is my father why I'm such a mess of anger, bravado, and temper?
is the fact that they call him a coward, the reason I walk around with my sword in hand, screaming that I'll make a pile of everyone's skulls, then stand on that to help me behead the people who were too tall for me to reach?
Kimmelin smiled fondly. Bless my stars, I asked her.
Every single one of them, Spencer. Every single bouncing star.
I sighed and took another drink. I don't know. I remember liking Grand-Grand's stories even before he was shot down, but what happened certainly didn't help. When everyone looks at you as the coward's daughter, not a coward's daughter, but the singular coward's daughter, you develop an attitude.
Well, bless you for standing up straight, she said, then put up her fists. Pride is a virtue in those who make it one,
said the saint.
She was a very wise woman.
You realize none of us have any idea which saint you're talking about.
Kimmelin patted me on the head. It's okay, dear. You can't help being a heretic. The saint forgives you.
From someone else that might have been offensive, particularly with the head pat. From Kimmelin, it was just, well, somehow comforting. By the end of the day, I was feeling a ton better. So much so, in fact, that I felt only mild nausea when they left me for dinner. So that was good. Outside, I spotted Jerkface getting into a long black hover car that had a driver wearing white gloves. Poor boy. Looks like he had to get a ride home now. I walked back to my cave with a spring in my step, chewing on some smoked rat. I would eventually have to pay some kind of vengeance bill to Jorgen, but I could do that. Bring it on. For now, I appeared to have gotten away with a serious crime. One starfighter-size power matrix, ready to go. I grinned as I arrived at my crevice, then lowered myself on my light line into the cavern. It was a silly thing to have risked my future over. The ship was so old, it wasn't like getting lights working was going to do any good. But it was also my secret, my discovery. My ship. Broken, worn out, with a bent wing. It was still mine. I hauled the matrix into position beside the ship's access hatch. The plugs were the same, so I didn't have to worry about hot-wiring it. I glanced at Doomslug, who inched over along the wing toward me, then grinned and plugged it in. The lights sprang to life on the diagnostic panel, and, judging by the glow from up front, on the dash inside the cockpit, the low humming tone from before started up again, then sped up, warping until it became words.
Emergency boot up procedures initiated,
a masculine voice said from the cockpit. It spoke with a strange old-timey accent, like I'd heard on the broadcasts of famous speeches from the days before we'd founded Alta.
Severe damage to structural integrity and data banks detected.
Was it a recording? I scrambled over to the cockpit.
Hello,
the voice said to me, growing less mechanical.
I assume from your clothing and attitude that you are a native of this locale. Would you kindly categorize yourself, stating your national affiliations and the names of your ancestors, so I might place you in my data tables?
I scratched my head. What in the stars?
Ah, the voice said. Excellent. Minimal linguistic deviation from Earth standard English. Forgive the slowness of my processing, which doesn't quite seem up to normal benchmarks, but you are human, yes? Could you tell me, where am I?
The words were lost on me. I simply knelt there, on the wing by the cockpit, trying to put together what was happening. My ship was talking to me. Chapter 17.
My designation is MB-1021, Robotic Ship Integration,
the ship said. It didn't just talk. It seemed to have trouble stopping.
But humans prefer names to designations, so I am commonly referred to as MBOT. I am a long-distance reconnaissance and recovery ship, designed for stealth operations and unsupported solo missions in deep space locations. And
the machine trailed off.
And? I asked, lounging in the cockpit, trying to figure out what in the stars this thing was.
And my data banks are corrupted,
Embot said.
I cannot recover further information. I can't even retrieve my mission parameters. The only record I have is the most recent order from my master. Lie low, Embot. Take stock. Don't get into any fights. And wait for me here.
Your master was your pilot, right? I asked.
Correct. Commander Spears.
He summoned a fuzzy image for me, which briefly replaced the scanner display on his dash. This Commander Spears was a clean-cut, youngish man with tan skin and a crisp, unfamiliar uniform. I've never heard of him, I said, and I know all the famous pilots, even from Grand-Grand's days in the fleet. What was up with the Krell when you came here? Had they attacked the galaxy yet?
I have no recollection of this group, and the word Krell doesn't appear in my memory banks.
He paused.
Reading the decay rate of isotopes in my memory core indicates that it has been 172 years since I was deactivated.
Huh, I said. The Defiant and its fleet crashed on Detritus about 80 years ago, and the Krell War started some distant time before that. Grand-Grand said the war had been going on a long time when she'd been born.
Considering human lifespans, Embot said, I must conclude that my pilot has perished. How sad.
Sad? I asked, trying to wrap my mind around this. You have emotions?
I am allowed self-improving and independently reinforcing memory pathways for the simulation of organic emotions. That allows me to have better interaction with humans, but I am not actually alive. My subroutines for emotional distress indicate I should feel for the loss of my master, but the memory banks recording his appearance and our history together are damaged. I remember nothing more than his name and his final command.
Lie low, I repeated. Take stock and don't get into any fights.
The only portion of my memory banks that seems to have survived intact, other than basic personality routines and things like general language usage, is an open database for recording fungoid life forms on this planet. I should very much like to fill the rest of it in.
Fungoid?
Mushrooms. Would you happen to have any I can categorize?
You're a hyper-advanced stealth fighter that, somehow, has a machine personality built into it. And you want me to bring you mushrooms?
Yes, please, Embot said. Take stock. As in, categorize local life forms. I'm certain that's what he meant.
I'm not so sure, I said. It sounded like you were supposed to hide from something. I leaned out the side, looking at his wings. You have large twin destructor emitters on each wing, along with a light lance turret underneath. That's as much firepower as our larger ships. You're a warship.
Clearly not, Embot said. I'm here to categorize fungi. Didn't you listen to my last orders? I am not supposed to get into fights.
Then why do you have guns?
For shooting large and dangerous beasts who might be threatening my fungus specimens, Embot said. Obviously.
That's stupid.
I am a machine, and my conclusions are therefore logical, while yours are biased by organic irrationality.
He made a few lights on his dash blink.
That is a clever way of saying you are the stupid one, in case you-
I understood, I said. Thanks.
You're welcome.
He sounded utterly sincere, but he was- what? A robotic integration? Whatever that was. I wasn't sure how far I could trust his honesty. Still, he was a machine with a memory, albeit damaged, that stretched back hundreds of years. This could be a solution, maybe, to the questions we'd always asked. Why did the Krell keep attacking us?
What were they, really? Our only depictions of them were reconstructions based on the armor they wore, as we'd never been able to take one of them captive. We'd probably once known the answers to these questions. But if so, we'd lost them 80 years ago. Soon after crashing here, and presuming themselves safe, the majority of the officers, scientists, and elders from our old fleet had gathered in an underground cavern. They'd recovered the old electronic archive from the Defiant, and had been holding an emergency meeting. That was when the first lifebuster had been dropped, destroying our archives, and with them, most anyone with seniority in the fleet. That was when the remnants of our people had broken into clans based on their duties in the fleet. Engine maintenance workers like Gran-Gran and her family. Hydroponics crew, glorified farmers like Bim's ancestors. Foot soldiers like Morningtides. They'd learned, through difficult trial and error, that if they kept to small groups of under 100 people, the Krell sensors couldn't find them hiding in the caves. Now, 3 generations later, here we were, slowly fighting our way back onto the surface, but with enormous holes in our memories and history. What if I could bring the ultimate secret to the DDF, the solution for defeating the Krell once and for all? Though, it was unlikely Imbot had that answer. After all, if the old human fleets had known how to defeat the Krell, they wouldn't have been driven to near extinction. But surely there were some secrets hidden inside this machine's mind. "Can you fire your weapons?" I asked.
"I'm commanded to avoid fights."
"Just answer," I said. "Can you fire?"
"No,"
Imbot said.
"The weapon systems are locked out of my control."
"Then why would your pilot order you not to get into any fights? You aren't capable of fighting anyone."
"Logically, one isn't required to be able to finish a fight in order to start one. I am allowed minimal basic autonomous movement and could theoretically stumble into a battle or a conflict. This would be disastrous for me on my own, as I require a pilot for most important functions. I can assist and diagnose, but as I am not alive, I cannot be trusted with destructive systems."
"So I could fire them," I said.
"Unfortunately, weapon systems are offline from damage."
"Great. What else is offline?"
"Other than my memories? Boosters, acclivity ring, cytonic hyperdrive, self-repair functions, the light lance, and all mobility functions. Also, my wing appears to be bent."
"Great. So, everything."
"My communications features and radar are functional," he noted, "as are cockpit life support and short-range sensors."
"And that's it?"
"That appears to be it."
He was silent for a moment.
"I can't help noticing, through the aforementioned short-range sensors, that you are in possession of a few mushrooms. Might you be willing to place those in my cockpit analyzer for cataloging?"
I sighed, resting back in my seat.
"At your leisure, of course. I, being robotic, have no concept of fragile things like human impatience."
"So what do I do?"
"But soon would be nice."
"I doubt I can fix this thing on my own," I thought. "Should I just go to the DDF and tell them what I'd found? I'd have to reveal that I'd stolen that power matrix. And, of course, they'd never let me keep this ship for myself. Going to the DDF with it would essentially mean wrapping this vessel up with a bow, then presenting it to the very admiral who was trying her best to ruin my life."
"They do look like nice mushrooms."
No, I was not going to give this discovery to Ironsides. At least not without more thought. But if I was going to try to repair this ship, I'd at least need help.
"Not that I require affirmation of any sort, as my emotions are mere simulations. But you are listening to me, right?"
"I'm listening," I said. "I'm just thinking."
"That is good. I should not like to be maintained by one who lacks brain functions."
It was at that moment that I had my third terrible idea in not so many days. I grinned. Maybe there was a way to get some help on the repairs. Someone who had way more brain functions than I had. Approximately an hour and a half later, well after curfew, I was hanging upside down by my light line outside Riggs' window on the third floor of his apartment complex in Igneous. He was snug inside, sleeping in his bunk. He had his own little closet of a room, which I'd always found luxurious. His parents had been deemed exemplary in all six parental metrics, and had been granted housing from multiple children, but ironically, Rig was the only one they'd ever ended up having. I knocked on his window, hair dangling below my head as I hung there. Then I knocked again. Then a little louder. Come on, it hadn't been that long since I'd last done this. Finally, the sleepyhead sat up, light through the window, from my light line, outlining his pale face and bleary eyes. He blinked at me, but didn't seem the least bit surprised as he walked over and slid the window open to the side.
Hey, he said, took you long enough.
Long enough?
To come try to talk me into coming back? Which I'm not going to do. I don't have everything figured out, but I'm still sure that my decision to—
Oh, shut up about that, I whispered. Grab your jumpsuit. I need to show you something. He raised an eyebrow. This is serious, I said. You're going to flip your boots when you see it. Infuriatingly, he just leaned on the windowsill, looking out at me as I was hanging there upside down, which was not easy, mind you.
It's almost midnight, Spin.
This will be worth it.
You're going to drag me off to some cavern, aren't you? I won't be back until like 2 or 3.
If you're lucky. He took a deep breath, then grabbed his jumpsuit.
You do realize that you're the weirdest friend I've ever had.
Oh, come on. Let's not pretend you have other friends.
Strange, he said, that my parents never managed to give me a sibling. But I still somehow ended up with a sister who gets me into trouble all the time.
I grinned. Meet you down below, I said. Then I paused. Flip your boots, Rig. Trust me.
Yeah, yeah. Give me a minute to sneak past my parents.
He pulled the drapes closed, and I let myself down to the street below, where I waited impatiently. Igneous was a strange place at night. The apparatus worked all hours, of course. Day and night were just words here, though we still used the terms. There was a mandatory quiet cycle, during which the cavern loudspeakers didn't play any announcements or speeches, and a curfew for those who weren't on last shift. But nobody paid attention to you as you walked the streets if you kept to your own business. The default assumption in Igneous was that everyone was going about something useful. Rig met me down at street level as promised, and we walked through the cavern, passing the mural of 1,000 birds in flight, each one divided in half by a line, the two halves slightly offset from each other. The birds soared from a red-orange sun, which you couldn't even see up above. Our cadet's pins got us past the guards and into the tunnels. As we walked one of the easier paths, Rig filled me in on what he'd been doing the last few weeks. His parents were happy he'd washed out. Everyone knew how dangerous being a pilot was.
They're proud, of course, Rig said, grunting as he climbed some rubble with me. Everyone treats me really strangely once they see the pin. Like, they listen to what I say and tell me my ideas are good, even if they aren't. And people make way for me, like I'm someone important.
You are.
No, I'm the exact same amount of important I was before.
He shook his head.
But I've got 12 different job offers waiting for me, and I've got 2 months to decide.
2 months? I repeated. Without a job or school? Just free time?
Yeah. Mrs. Vermeer keeps trying to push me toward politics.
Politics, I said, almost stopping in the tunnel.
You. Tell me about it.
He sighed and sat down on a nearby rock.
But what if she's right? Shouldn't I listen to her? Everyone else thinks politics is the best thing you can do with your life. Maybe I should do what they say.
What do you want, though?
Now you care about that?
He asked.
I winced, and Rig looked away, blushing deeply.
I'm sorry, Spin. That wasn't fair. I haven't been fair. To you, I mean. I chose to study for the pilot's test. You didn't make me. And yes, your dreams kind of consumed my own. But that's mostly because I didn't have any dreams. Not really.
He slumped on his rock, back to the wall, looking up at the tunnel ceiling.
I keep thinking, what if it happens again? What if I let myself get excited about a job, then discover I'm completely unsuited to it? I failed at flying, right? So maybe I'll just keep failing?
Rig, I said, taking him by the arm. The problem isn't that you're going to be unsuited to what you pick. The problem is what it's always been. That you're simply too scudding great at too many different things.
He looked up at me. Do you really believe that, Spin?
Sure do. I mean, yeah, you decided flying wasn't for you. But I think if you have a flaw, it's not that you fail too often. It's that you refuse to admit what everyone sees. The fact that you're incredible.
He smiled. And seeing Rig's smile felt good. It reminded me of our days as kids, when an outcast and a kid who was bullied had made friends against the odds.
You're going to drag me into something again, aren't you? He asked. Something ridiculous?
I hesitated. Yeah, probably.
All right, he said, standing up. I guess I'm in. Let's go see this surprise of yours.
We continued on, climbing until I led him, finally, out a gap onto the surface. I pulled him over to the entrance to my improvised home, then made him hold on to me as I lowered us down inside, as, well, the chances that he'd slip and fall were pretty good. He really was amazing at a ton of things, but I'd seen him drop no fewer than 8 books on his toes while studying this past year.
This had better not be something to do with rats, Spin, he said as we landed. I know you go crazy for them, but...
I turned up the light on my light line, illuminating the ship. As if in coordination with my reveal, M-Bot turned on his dash and running lights. I'd cleared away much of the rubble, and with the lights, the ship didn't look half bad. Broken, yes, with a bent wing, but distinctly different from anything we had in the DDF. Rig gaped at it, his jaw dropping practically to the floor. Well, I said, what do you think? In response, he sat down on a nearby boulder and, still staring at the ship, pulled off his right boot, then flipped it over his shoulder. Well, I noted, I said boots, plural. But I'll take it. Chapter 18. I didn't get much sleep that night. I spent a few hours helping Rig look over M-Bot. He wanted to check each bit of damage. Eventually, though, I started to get bleary-eyed. Rig was still going strong, so I rolled out a mat and used bloodletter for a pillow. Every time I dozed off, I'd eventually wake to hear Rigmarole speaking to the ship.
So, you're a machine, but you can think.
All machines think, in that they execute responses to input. I am simply far more complex in my executable responses, and in the inputs I can recognize.
More dozing.
Can explain to us what is wrong?
My memory banks are faulty, so I cannot offer more than cursory explanations. But perhaps those will be sufficient.
I turned over on my side and dipped back down into sleep.
Do not know where I originated, although a fragment of a memory implies I was created by human beings. I am not certain whether other species of sapient life exist. I believe I could answer that once.
Around 6 in the morning, I rubbed my eyes and sat up. Rig lay below an open access panel, fiddling with something underneath the ship. I flopped down next to him, yawning. So?
It's incredible, he said. Have you told Cobb about it?
Not yet.
Why delay? I mean, what if this thing can make the difference in fighting the Krell?
Theoretically, I said, humans had this thing when they first fought the Krell. It didn't help them.
I would note, M'Bot said, that it is listening.
And? I asked the ship, yawning again.
And it's generally considered bad form for humans to speak of one who is present as if they are not.
I can't make you out, M'Bot, Rig said, sitting up.
You say you don't care about things like that, right? Obviously, I don't. I'm a logical machine with only a thin veneer of simulated emotions.
Okay, Rig said. That makes sense.
It's still rude,
M'Bot added. I looked to Rig, then gestured toward the cockpit. So, we have a magical talking starship with mysterious technology. Do you want to help me fix it?
On our own? Rig asked. Why?
So we can keep it. And fly it.
You're in the DDF now, Spin. You don't need an outdated, broken-down ship. Still here, M'Bot noted. Just saying.
I leaned forward. Rig, I'm not in the DDF. I'm in Cobb's class.
So? You'll graduate. I don't care how few people he passes. You'll be one of them.
And then? I asked, feeling cold. Expressing a fear that I'd never voiced, but one that had haunted me since that first day. Cobb says he can let anyone he wants into his class. But if I pass, his authority ends there, Rig. Rig looked down at the wrench in his hand. I'm worried that the Admiral will deny me a ship, I said. Worried she'll find some petty reason to kick me out once Cobb can't protect me anymore. Worried I'll lose it, Rig. The sky. I looked toward the ship, glowing with lights along its side. This is old, yes, but it's also my freedom. He still looked skeptical. Think about how fun it would be, I said, poking around inside an ancient ship. Think of what mysteries we could discover. Maybe M'Bot is all outdated technology, but maybe not. Won't it be fun to at least try to fix him on our own? If it doesn't work out, we can always turn him in later.
Fine, Rig said. All right, stop giving me the hard sell. I'll try, Spin.
I grinned at him.
Rig looked at the ship. I worry this is beyond what we can do. Those boosters are ruined. We can't just weld something like that back together. I'm sure there will be other parts that will need to be replaced or fixed using tools we don't have.
He thought for a moment.
Though, what? I asked. One of my job offers, he said. It's from the Elite Engineering Corps, the people who oversee repairing the starfighters, and the people who develop new designs. They've got the best labs, the best equipment.
I nodded, eager. That sounds perfect.
I was thinking of taking their offer anyway, he said. They told me I could come in these next 2 months, intern with them, learn my way around the shops. They were very impressed with my test scores, and with my understanding of schematics and advanced engineering.
Rig, that is awesome.
I'm not promising anything, he said. But, well, maybe if I bring them the right questions, I can get them to show me how to fix certain pieces of M'Bot. I'll have to do it without making them suspicious. Regardless, we'll still need spare parts. At least one full-size booster.
I'll find us one, somehow.
Just don't tell me where you get it, he noted. Maybe, when this whole thing blows up in our faces, I can claim I didn't know about any possible thefts you might be up to. A small decal on that power matrix reads, Property of the Weight Family, M'Bot said helpfully. It looks to have been ripped, quite crudely, from a small chassis. Blue finish, judging by the scratched-off paint on the corner.
Rig sighed.
Jorgen's car? Really?
I plastered on a smile.
The internship will take a chunk of each day, he said, rubbing his chin. But I should be able to dedicate the rest to this, if I need to. I'll have to tell my parents something.
Tell them the internship is super demanding, I suggested, and that it will take the majority of your time.
But, Mbot said, that's not true, is it?
Nah, I said, but who cares?
I care, the machine said. Why would you say something that isn't true?
You can simulate emotions, I said, but not lies.
I appear to be missing some code,
Mbot said.
Curious. Oh, what an interesting fungus.
I frowned, then glanced to the side, to where Doomslug had crawled up on a rock.
Scud, Rig said. There's some weird stuff up here close to the surface.
He shivered. Can you do something about that thing? That thing is named Doomslug, I said, and she's my mascot. Don't hurt her while I'm away. I walked over, grabbing my pack. I need to get to class. You going to head below?
Nah, Rig said. I suspected I might not be back for a while, so I left a note for my parents, saying I was going to an employment meeting. They'll just assume I got up before them. I can head down later. I want to have a look at his wiring first.
Great, I said. If you're still here when I get back from class each day, I'll join you in the repairs. If not, leave me notes telling me what I can do to help. I hesitated. Remember, I'm kind of a dunderhead at this, so you might want to give me the easy but annoying tasks. Rig smiled once more, settling down on a rock, looking at Mbot. There was a light in his eyes, one I remembered from back when we started planning to become pilots. In that moment, seeing Rig like that again, I had my first real impression that this might work. Somehow this plan might just work.
Wait, Mbot said. You're leaving me with him?
I'll be back tonight, I promised.
I see. Could you come to the cockpit so we can speak in private?
I looked at the ship, frowning.
I don't want to explain in public why I like you better than the engineer,
Mbot added.
If he heard me go on, at length, regarding his irresolvable flaws, he might feel belittled or despondent. Well, that part is going to be lovely, Rig said, rolling his eyes. Maybe we can find a way to shut off the personality.
I pulled myself up into the cockpit. The canopy moved down and sealed with a whoosh. It's all right, I said to Mbot. Rig is good people. He'll take care of you.
I am, of course, simply emulating the way humans play irrational favorites over one another. But could you not go?
I'm sorry. I've got to go learn to fight the Krell. I frowned at the tone in the robot's voice. What's wrong? I told you, Rig is a good—
I am willing to accept that he is, until evidence proves otherwise. This is a problem. I appear to have lost my master.
I can be your new master.
I cannot change masters without proper authentication codes, he said, which I just realized I do not remember. The problem, however, is larger than this mere fact. I do not remember my mission. I do not know where I came from. I do not know my purpose. If I were human, I would be scared.
How did I respond to that? A frightened starship? Don't worry, I said. We'll give you a new purpose, destroying the Krell. You're a fighter, Mbot. I'm sure that name stands for something exciting. Murderbot, Mayhembot, Massacrebot. That's it, I'm sure. You're a frightening, all-powerful death ship designed to fry the Krell and save humanity.
I do not feel very frightening, he said. I do not feel like a death ship.
We'll deal with that, I promised. Trust me.
And can I trust that those words are not a falsehood? Like the one to tell the engineer's parents?
Well, that came back to bite me faster than I'd expected.
I must ask you, Mbot said more softly, not to tell any others about me. I assumed you'd understood this earlier when I explained my orders. I am supposed to lie low, which is a colloquialism for remaining inconspicuous. You should not have told the engineer.
And how would we repair you otherwise?
I do not know. Spensa, I am an artificial intelligence, a computer. I must obey my orders. Please, you can't turn me over to your DDF. You must not even speak of me to anyone else.